Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and he's back for a third appearance in the book club. A welcome return this evening to Johnny Cannon. Hello, Johnny.
How you doing, Eamon? It's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you very much for answering the call, which we'll get to in a moment. I'll just mention episode 171, Excalibur, 277, Garth. So we've talked about Alan Davis, one of your absolute favourites. We've talked about the inky noodlings of Frank Bellamy. Now, we're coming to it. Your choice for your third visit to the book club, which was one you've answered the call because I put up the bat signal. Tell us what you've come back to instruct me about.
Jings, this is a good one. I'm here to talk to you about The Bruins in Urwilly. Specifically the work of Dudley D. Watkins from 1946 to 1956, the golden years, according to D.C. Thompson. I really think that is the golden years, according to D.C. Thompson, frankly. Aye, so that's what we're going to be talking about today, and also Scotland versus Denmark as well, if you want.
Okay. And which goal was your favourite? Okay. So we've got, you very kindly sent me the hardback, one of these D.C. Thompson collections, which, as you say, is 1946 to 1956, The Golden Years, by R.D. Lowe and mostly by Dudley D. Watkins, I'm going to guess, featuring strips that first appeared in the D.C. Thompson newspaper, The Sunday Post, between those years. Which, just before we started recording, you tell me the Sunday Post still exists.
Yes, it's a long-run newspaper, yeah. So I did warn you I might burst into tears in this podcast because of my very personal connection to the Sunday Post in the Bruins in Urwilly. Because when I was a wee boy, we used to go to my gran and papa's house every Sunday. And they lived in Livingston Terrace in Irvine. It's a very, very working class part of Ayrshire. It was my dad's mum and dad. And my papa was spit of Paul Bruin. He had a moustache and he did just dress like Paul Bruin. And my dad had a moustache. My uncle Kevin, who's my dad's brother, had a moustache. My grandpa, who's my mum's dad, had a moustache. My dad's best pal, or Uncle Johnny, had a moustache. And also I've grown up to have a moustache. So the Bruins I'm predisposed to like because it's genetically in me. But it was funny because at that house, it was just like the Bruins. It was a very working class household. And it was people coming in and out. My cousins, Keith and Susan, and later on Kyle, would come in and out. My sister would sometimes come along. My wee brother, who's 7 years younger than me, would come along when he was a bit younger. But I used to be so bored because people would just sit and talk, adults in the living room, just sit and smoke and talk, and the whole room would be filled with smoke. He was sitting there so bored. So I would read the Sunday Post. And because I was obsessed with comics, it was always Urwilly and the Bruins. And after a while, I realised, hey, my papa looks just like Paul Bruin. And I remember years later, my dad showed me this picture of my papa's dad and his granddad. And it was just this classic Victorian picture of three guys in flat caps with huge moustaches and suits looking really angry, just really stern. And so, I mean, there is a very particular type of Scottishness in these strips. I mean, it's absolutely not Britishness. It is Scottishness, and it's very, very working class. And that is just something that really chimed with my childhood, but also there is that personal connection because I still do miss my late gran and papa who died years ago. Do you know, I never even realised when I was a wee boy that everyone in my family, my dad's side of the family, because he's very working class, and myself, we actually did speak Scots, and I never realised that for years until I think it was probably when I went to university, when everyone sounded posher than me, and it was certain words that people were like, what? And Scots is interesting because I think maybe some people think it's a dialect when it's not. It's a language. It's like modern English is derived from a West Germanic language. So I think it's early Middle English. And it is quite different. But you have regional dialectical variations. And one of the ways I knew that was from reading The Bruins, because the wee girl, the wee four-year-old is called the bairn. But in the west coast of Scotland I'm from, should be called the Wain, because that Bairns, something that's east of Falkirk. I don't even have the jock term since Bairns. So there's a history of my family. That's all I've got to talk about today. And a wee history of the Scots language. So it's still going strong and has been, and it's a conservative newspaper with a small C. It's very traditional. It's very folksy. It's the kind of thing you'd still get recipes in. It's very safe. It's very much kind of a, I wouldn't say Victorian family values, but it's a family newspaper. You know, and that, I mean, if you read the Bruins and Oor Willie, I mean, that absolutely comes out because there is, you know, there's certain stuff I've read about W.D. Watkins' work. I was quite surprised because it was like, that's, you know, like Oor Willie, David Roach describes as an anarchic character. And I was like, I just don't see that. Dennis the Menace, like David Law's Dennis the Menace, absolutely. Or Leo Baxendale's Men in the Mix, absolutely. But not Oor Willie. Oor Willie's just a wee boy. You know, he's, you know, he's actually a good wee boy quite a lot of time. I wish my son was that well behaved, but sadly he's not.
Tell us about the two strips. Give us the sort of the details. Who are the Bruins?
Aye. So the Bruins is a large cast. There's Pa Bruin, who are probably, in these strips, certainly, I would argue, is the main protagonist. And there's, if you remind me later on, when we do our 30-minute long inking chat, there is something that W.D. Watkins does that's a commonality across both strips. So I would argue he's the main protagonist of these selected stories, certainly. There's Ma Bruin, who is very much the boss of the household, even back in these strips, although they might have purposely chosen the strips that weren't too sexist. There's multiple children of varying ages from late 20s, early 30s, down to 4. And one of the strips when I was reading it, because many a times when I was a kid, I was reading the Bruins, I was like, how old is Pa Bruin and Ma Bruin meant to be? Because they look really old. But it's one of those things when you look at a picture of Sean Connery, the 1960s, and you're like, God, Sean Connery is where he's old. Hang on a minute, he's no 50 there, he's 20. And it's that kind of thing. But there's a strip in this one early on that's set 40 years earlier, and it's Grandpa Bruin and Pa Bruin going to the theatre, and you're like, hang on a minute, Pa Bruin's clearly about 30 in that. Is he meant to be like 70 years old, a four-year-old child? And when I was a kid, I somehow got it in my head that the Bruins, like, he was a widower and he'd remarried, and like Hen and Joe were kids from a previous match. That's never in the strips. That's just what I assumed when I was a kid, because it was just, you know, there was one family that lived near me that did have like 10 kids, but it just, they all look so different as well. And that always used to be a joke when you're growing up amongst your pals, why the Bruins all looked completely different and few of them looked like Pa Bruin. But anyway, there's Pa Bruin, there's Ma Bruin, there's Hen and Joe, who are the two oldest boys. There's Maggie and Daphne, who are the two girls. There's Horace, who's the wee specky guy, who I think probably my family equated me to, the wee weird brainy specky kid. There's the twins, who look quite like Oor Willie. And there's the bairn, who's the baby of the family. And she's 4 years old, but does speak in baby talk, which can be off-putting. And there's also Grandpa Bruin. And Grandpa Bruin, he's probably my favourite character, just because he steals the show and he shows up because he's so stupid. But he's an idiot. But also, not so much, it's only there in a couple of the strips in here, but a lot of the strips I read growing up, he had a very, like, him and, like, he was the bairn's favourite. So they had wee mini adventures in later Bruin strips. That's only really there present, like I said, in a couple of the strips here. So it's a big cast, and they live in Glebe Street in a wee town that's later on, it's called Auchinshugel, but it's not. So there's this myth that it was never named until like later on, and like much, much later on in the strip. And Oor Willie's from the same town as well. I don't know if you noticed in one of the strips in this, when they go to the judo, they go to Craigie Gym. Mm-hmm. Craigie Bank is a part of Dundee, and like Craigie High School is as well. So I think originally this was, and certainly the way it reads, it could either be Dundee or it could be Glasgow, because the Bruins is very much like, it could be Glasgow or Dundonian tenemental life. you know, because you live in a wee flat, like all the boys share the same bed, you know, so, and that was a common working class thing. You know, you would have a wee recess in the living room where the mum and dad would sleep, and then you would have a wee recess in the kitchen. The kids would sleep. You'd have a shelf above it where additional kids could sleep as well when you had larger families. So that's the Bruins. It's a huge cast, and basically it's just their misadventures based on constantly arguing, which was quite like my family, although my family was smaller.
I've got another Bruins collection here in front of me to celebrate their upcoming 90th birthday, and it describes them on the title page as Scotland's happy family that makes every family happy.
Right, okay.
Are they the happy family that have gone through and moved through time in this sort of, in this fashion?
They're clearly a family that are very close and that love each other. But delight in, I assume all families, well, I don't know about all families, I assume a lot of families are like this, where people relentlessly harass each other and take the piss out of each other, a lot of times through sheer boredom. But also, if particularly if you're growing up in a working class household, there's not a lot of money, you know, you make sometimes hard circumstances fun, and that's absolutely there in our world too. It's remarkable actually how so it's not just reflecting that immediate post-war period, like, you know, that time of rationing and real hardship and a country being rebuilt. That is something that was certainly there by the 1970s. When I started reading the comics, I would have been reading them. I was born in 1974, and I started reading when it was 3 or 4, just before I went to school. And that was there then. It was there then possibly because they were still reprinting Dudley D. Watkins strips into the 70s because he worked on them until 1969 when he died. And there was, I think, quite a long transitionary period. And certainly that's something that maybe has stuck with the Bruins in particular, that it's this kind of almost detrimentally nostalgic. You know, it's very much set in the past. Something, as you described, as timeless. When I was growing up, it was seen as something that was very, very old-fashioned. The Sunday Post is seen as very, very old-fashioned. As time's gone on, and we're speaking about this before we started recording, in the past maybe 10 years, because they were promoting the anniversaries of the strips, particularly Oor Willie, there was the Bruins cookbook, which was a big success, and there was also the Oor Willie bucket trail and big bucket trail where there were statues of Oor Willie sitting in his bucket across Scotland, painted in different colours. So it's become something that is as Scottish as Tunnock's tea cakes or Iron Brew or those tea towels you get with a map of Scotland on them. They seem to be everywhere. I see them everywhere I go. Doesn't matter where I am. Everyone's got one. I think it's mandatory when you buy a house in Scotland, they just hide one in your house. So I mean, the family does love each other, but there is that. I mean, it wouldn't be that. I mean, let's be honest, it wouldn't be funny. They all got on. So many stories in that.
They have moved through time with their appearance not really changing a great deal, apart from Maggie, who's the sort of the fashion plate young lady. Her fashions maybe have changed over the years.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you mentioned popular culture in recent years, the cookbook and so on. Scottish celebrities have started showing up in the strip from time to time, haven't they?
It's quite funny. The one that I remember most was Frank Quitely.
Right.
Because Frank Quitely had an exhibition, I think, in 2017 at Kelvin Grove Art Gallery Museum in Glasgow. And he famously is a huge fan of Dudley D. Watkins. And you can see in his style, particularly the line work, there is a lot of Dudley D. Watkins in there. And there's something we can get onto later on if we want to talk more about Dudley D. Watkins' art style. In the Comics Journal 300th issue, back in, I think it's 2009, Dave Gibbons and Frank Quitely are talking, and they get into Dudley D. Watkins, and they talk quite a bit about him. So, in Frank Quitely, I think it would have been in the early 1990s, there was a underground comic produced in Glasgow at Hope Street Studios called Electric Soup, and he created a strip called The Greens, which is based in the Bruins. which was really popular, which ran in it. And that was when Frank Quitely was really breaking into comics. And that's when he first started using the pseudonym Frank Quitely, because I don't think he wanted his family to know it was him that was doing it, which is the same reason why I'm called Johnny Cannon. So,
So okay, the Bruins. We've got to mention Al Woolley. I know I'm saying that wrong.
You are saying that wrong, aye?
Yeah. Who's this young lad?
Ur Woolley, Ur Woolley, Abadie's Woolley. That's it. So Ur Woolley is a young. He's not really that mischievous. It's not like Dennis the Menace. You know, it's gentler stories than that. He's a wee boy with either, sometimes you see him with different coloured hair, with either blonde or ginger spiky hair, who wears black dungarees, and he sits in a bucket. It's very iconic, and it's very, very specific. And his fashion has not changed over the years. And I'm pretty sure any wee boy in Scotland has ever seen Ur Woolley at some point in his life has dreaded the thought that his mum is going to buy him a pair of dungarees for his Christmas. And he'll be made to wear them. So, aye. And he's got a cast of characters. When I go through the names, you'll realise why I'm laughing. So there's Ur Woolley. There's Fat Bob. There's Wee Eck. And really, just to push it over the edge, there's Soapy Souter. Now, I don't know if this is a Scottish thing, or you've maybe noticed a theme in these names. And given there is DC Thompson, I don't know if it was an in-joke by R.D. Lowe or W.D. Watkins. I doubt it was W.D. Watkins, who's a very religious man by all accounts, at how little they were paid, that they named them, gave them those names, because in different parts of Scotland, those are euphemisms for a certain part of the male body, and certainly Soapy Souter either was then or has become a euphemism for something you do with that part of the body when you're by yourself.
Okay.
So, and I did ask, actually, I better not say that just in case DC Thompson listened to this. I did ask someone to corroborate, is that an urban myth or is that true? And he went, it's absolutely true. It's a reliable source. And I went, okay. It's quite funny we're doing this week, because you kind of talk about these strips without talking about Scottishness, and obviously Scotland's had a pretty good week by qualifying for the World Cup. But the other weird thing is, we've had mice in our garage, and this week I caught a mouse in a mousetrap. So we got a humane mousetrap, so I took it out to the field with my kids and we released it. It's a beautiful wee thing. And what's funny is my son called it Jimmy, like just randomly. And I was like, why are you calling it that? And he said, it's just a good name for it. And I said, right, okay. And the funny thing is Ur Woolley famously has a wee mouse. He doesn't show up in these strips. And his wee mouse is called Jimmy. And his wee mouse he carries about in the front pocket of his dungaree. So I don't know if you've ever seen one of the Ur Woolley strips where he does that. And his wee mouse is run along his shoulder. And there's various stories where he loses wee Jimmy somewhere, and he's got to rescue it. A bit like Billy's Boots, where he's trying to rescue his manky boots, except it's a mouse. So that's his cast of characters. And also there's, he lives with his mum and his dad, or Ma and Feather. And there's PC Murdoch as well, who does change over time, because he goes from having a police helmet to a police hat. Because in Scotland, they get rid of police helmets when I was a wee boy, and they moved to the kind of more flat cap.
The peaked cap thing, yeah.
And I do remember, I think it was when he had the, I must have been when he had the helmet. One of my favourite strips when I was a wee boy, Ur Woolley's always trying to knock off his helmet to see what's underneath it. And eventually knocks it over. And PC Murdoch keeps his jam pieces for his lunch under his helmet. And I just found that. I don't know, it's always stuck in my head. Anytime anyone has jam, I always think of that. It's totally burned into my mind. And there's various different kind of female characters who appear over the years, but Willie's at that age where he feels weird around girls. So I would place him round about 10 years old. What is notable in these strips, and it's funny you saying about how Maggie's a character that changes, Ur Woolley, over the course of these strips, I don't know if you noticed this as well, he does age slightly, he ages up. And I think that's similar to Charles Schultz's work in Peanuts, where he's refining his model So his on-model version of the characters is changing slightly as his art style is improving and as he's getting better at drawing. And because, I mean, he was quite a prolific artist, because he was also doing Desperate Dan, Lord Snooty, you know, and doing Sunday strips, the big job, particularly the Bruins, where it's such a big cast, because I'm assuming he drew the Bruins in particular quite big, to just because it's such a complicated strip to draw. Urwell is different, and it really comes across in art style how it's looser, it's quicker. But you do notice that kind of transformation, a gradual transformation in the Urwell character getting slightly older.
Now, I was familiar with him sitting on his bucket.
Yes.
Because I'd seen the statues. Right. But this was the first collection that I'd read, and I didn't realise that every full-page strip, the first panel, he's sitting on his bucket, and the last panel, he's back on his bucket.
Aye.
They're different poses drawn by Dudley D. Watkins. Mm-hmm. And he's almost, in his last panel at times, he's almost like the Ronnie Corbett character talking to the camera, in that he gives his little moment of summation or punchline.
I never thought of that, but you're right. I wonder, and Ronnie Corbett is Scottish, I wonder if that's where he actually got it from.
Yeah. It's just, you know, he's in his first panel, he's usually, well, I think he's, no, he's not always, but he's usually silent in his first panel.
Aye.
But in his last panel, he gets a one-liner to sum up his adventures.
And it's either a punchline or it's sometimes it's pathos. So one thing that's not in this reproduction, that was certainly, it was all the ones that I read as a wee kid growing up, and you're talking well over 14 years of me reading that, and ones I've seen since, they used to have a poem in Scots at the top of the page as well, because the, you know, the every so one of the things about Urwillie and the Bruins, which is why they're so embedded in Scottish culture, is because they do, DC Thompson does an annual every year, and it's 1 year it's Urwillie and then the next year it's the Bruins, and so on, it alternates. And in the back of every Urwillie annual, it does the, you know, the Urwillie, Urwillie, Aberdeen's Willie, in the back of all of them. And at the top of each strip was this poem in Scots in every instalment, because it was usually Urwillie was the first page in the Sunday Post fun section, which is where they both originated. It was the 8th of March, 1936. And that's quite interesting that happened, because D.C. Thompson was a very, very successful company. And they published newspapers, magazines, but they were quite slow to get into comics. I think the Dandy was 1937 and the Beano was 7 months later. And then they had, what was it called? The Magic Comic, which was 1939. But because of paper shortages during the war, all that got cancelled. But prior to that, they had Rover, Wizard, Adventure, The Hotspur, and there was one other one. It was the Big Five. Was it Champion? I can't remember the name of the other one. And AP had they were a big publisher, and they would publish comics that had a circulation of around about 500,000. Those publications that DC Thompson were doing, they weren't comics. They were children's story papers. So it was prose fiction, but with an illustrated cover. So that's where Dudley D. Watkins started working for them, was drawing, you know, the spot illustrations in those stories. And I don't quite know what prompted their move into comic strips in 1936. But what's remarkable is it must have been a massive success, because they went so quickly, like a year later, into the Dandy and the Beano, and Dudley D. Watkins was part of that. There was also, I mean, there was a couple of other really good cartoonists. They had Chick Gordon and Alan, oh my gosh, I can't remember his name. Sorry, I need to check. Oh my goodness, what's his name?
Alan Morley.
I think so.
Yeah, first worked for D.C. Thompson in 1925.
Yeah. Yeah, Alan Morley. I'm sorry about that, terrible memory. So they were their kind of three main artists, and they were all involved in that. But it's remarkable, it really, you know, that he was one of the centrepiece for that. And it's interesting, because I was reading David Broach's Master of Masters of British Comic Art, and seeing what he said about Dudley D. Watkins. And there's a section in there which talks about the kind of evolution of British newspaper strips. And also, I'd been looking at Dennis Gifford's International Book of Comics, and there's quite a lot about Dudley D. Watkins and Ur-Willy and the Bruins in there. It's not really surprising because even though they are very, very Scottish, they are a big deal because at one point the Sunday Post was the highest read newspaper per capita in the world because for a long time, you know, Scottish people read more newspapers per capita than anywhere else for whatever reason. And the Sunday Post was so popular. So I'm just looking to see what he said about... Ah, here it is here. So this David Roach, Thompson's secret weapon was Dudley D. Watkins, a man who drew with energy, conviction, and just an edge of anarchy. Watkins introduced readers to Barrel-Chested Desperate Dan in the Dandy's first issue, followed by Lord Snooty and the Beano. He also drew adventure serials like Shipwreck Circus and Jimmy and his Magic Peach. Sorry, Jimmy and his Magic Patch. He should have gone for the Magic Peach. Obviously, someone beat him to it. And for the Beano throughout the 40s, with his workload increased yet further with Biffo the Bear in 1948. Watkins' art was detailed and direct, with each panel showing full figures and detailed backgrounds, much like watching a play, but portrayed with an impish sense of humour. And I don't quite agree with the anarchic side of it, which we can get into if you want, because I think that's something I equate more with the work of, you know, like Davy Law, Ken Reid, but certainly, absolutely a Leo Baxendale, like Bath Street Kids and Minnie the Minx. I mean, his Leo Baxendale stuff, like, I mean, his style could slip seamlessly into an underground comic. It's bananas. I love his work. I love Dudley D. Watkins' work. And Ken Reid and Leo Baxendale were my favourite humour artists when I was a kid. You know, like Sweeney Todd, so disturbing. It's like really, really, it was deranged. Absolutely deranged. And Ur-Willy to me is not like that. Ur-Willy to me, it is charming. It's very charming. It's delightful. It is also genuinely funny at times. I was genuinely surprised reading back through, because a lot of these strips I recognised from reading when I was a kid because of those reprints and the reprinted strips and annuals. I'd read them before, but I wasn't laughing out of familiarity. I was laughing because, you know, I think they're at their funniest when they're just stupid. Like when Willy and Fat Bob somehow get a pantomime donkey costume and split up. A dog goes into the back and the front end. So it's a dog in the front end of the pantomime donkey one about, and then Irwin trips on a bat and gets a stuffed ram's head on his head. And he's sitting there walking about all the time like this. It's just stupid. And it's just, I don't know. I think there's, you know, and that's obviously something comics like Viz took to extremes, you know, decades later.
Yeah.
And that's the type of humour that really came out in the Beano and the Dandy for me. What was also telling to me with Ur-Willy was, again, this could be because of the time period in which the collection was published, was that there's only a couple of times he's shown me that he's got a scalped arse from this bit even, whereas the Beano and the Dandy, his dad's running about trying to strangle them, a belt on with slippers.
Corporal punishment, yeah.
Exactly. Well, that's one way of describing it. Describing it, you know, on capital punishment. But Ur-Willy, certainly I don't remember being that extreme. And I don't know if, again, that was down to the values of Dudley D. Watkins, but also the Sunday Post was a very moderate, very traditional, very centrist, very, you know, big in decency and integrity. I mean, there's an element of hypocrisy in that as well, as there usually is with these political editorial bents. But certainly that was something that was in those strips, almost oppressively so at times.
So you mentioned 8th of March 1936, so they're both coming up for their 90th birthday in the new year. The Sunday Post, we've mentioned R.D. Lowe, writer, editor. I wonder how much the fun section of the Sunday Post was down to him. Because as you say, he will then launch the Dandy and the Beano a year or so later. And as you say, from 1939 onwards, they mostly had annual collections, although I think they skipped a couple in the war years because of paper shortages. Yeah. I mean, I know you were reading the Sunday Post at your grandparents. Did you see collections of De Bruyne's or Willie? Yeah.
Well, there wasn't the kind of hardback collections back then. It was very much the alternating annuals. Just to go back to your point you made there about kind of who did what, and you can get an insight from the way that John Wagner and Pat Mills talk about their time at DC Thompson, but also how IPC used to package up comics where they'd get an editor on, they would bundle it together, they would select the artists. And from what I've read, I think it was very much R.D. Lowe was putting this fun section, this originally was eight pages fun section together, but now to four pages, he said, because of the paper shortages. And Dudley D. Watkins was the main illustrator for both. I think Chick Gordon, he did a strip that was dropped after a couple of years called Och and Togol, which is quite similar to Och and Shugle, which is the name that was adopted for the Bruins and Oor Willie. Och and Shugle is actually a real place as well in Glasgow. It's where the trams used to terminate in the east end of the city. But it's not the same Och and Shugle that's in the Bruins and Oor Willie. I think I just use it because it sounds a bit like Och and Togol. And Och and Togol was the sometimes used as the name of the town as well. So it's just a word that was there. Aye, so that kind of start of who did what, I think it was probably more, R.D. Lowe was probably more heavily involved at the start. And then what's interesting with Dudley D. Watkins is I think he was the only artist that was actually allowed to sign his name. And he was very, very important to the company. One of the things I'd read about him was during the Second World War, the company argued that he was too important an asset to be conscripted and to be called up for service. So he did his service domestically in Fife and continued to draw the strips. So I don't know if that was because of he was seen to be integral to like the national morale, which is I mean, these were really, really, like really, really big selling strips. And it's similar to America with like over a similar time period, like Terry and the Pirates was around about 1936 as well. You know, Tintin was 1929. I think Lucky Luke was like 1943. So you had these huge strips springing up and they were really important because that's what shifted hundreds of thousands, in the case of America, millions of units. You know, your Alex Raymonds, your Milton Kenneth, your Hal Fosters. Dudley D. Watkins was the equivalent in Scotland, which is obviously a much, much smaller country. But again, you've got a lot of people consuming newspapers.
Now, before I turn you loose on the artwork, we'll just mention, of course, it is written in Scotch, as I might say, and it made certain words and expressions enter into the sort of common vernacular, I would say. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Jings, Crivens, Help My Bob, from Oor Willie, your top three, probably for Oor Willie. You know, there's certain terms of endearment, certainly, that I've heard, like, people in my family use, like, oh, gosh, what's the thing that the bairns usually call? My wee lamb. Like, I've heard my wife call my daughter lamb, and she's really wee. It's such an old-fashioned thing, and I've caught myself saying it to my daughter as well before. It's like, oh, my God, that's like from the Bruins. It's just, so they have entered the modern lexicon. Funnily enough, years and years ago, long before I met my wife, my girlfriend at the time was complaining to me that I swore too much. I really am bad. I try and behave myself in your podcast, but I'm terrible for swearing. I have terrible language. And so to give up swearing, I started saying instead, jings, crivens. I couldn't say help my Bob, because obviously where I come from, Bob means something specific, as we've discussed. And she gets so annoyed with me. She just told me to go back to swearing after about 2 days. Shut up. You know, Oor Willie, I can't take it anymore. So it's the Scottish thing's funny because, like I was saying, I didn't realise when I was a kid that I was actually speaking Scots. There's just so many Scots words that are used every day in Scotland. Like, you notice that when, like, if I'm writing something, I remember when I was doing the spell check, I couldn't believe it that out with, it's a Scots word. I thought it was English. It's like, really? And I've said that to like English friends, like, what? You mean without? And I said, no, out with, it's a word. And it's kind of like outside.
probably,
it's probably Russ Abbott was, he used to do that See You Jimmy thing, which is infuriating. But I think it's like Och Aye the Noo. I don't know anyone that actually says Och Aye the Noo, but I do say Och Aye quite a lot, or Och, you know, or a wee this, a wee that. So aye, there's I don't know, I think it's quite a, I don't know if it's because of I think I've got quite a rough accent, but there's certain parts of Scotland where Scots, it sounds very musical, but there is such a strong tradition of music in Scotland and also Ireland as well, and the two countries are very strongly linked. That's maybe why it's such a musical language to my ear, because where I was brought up in Ayrshire, it's quite near where Robert Burns, was born. And so in Ayrshire, you get Burns every year in the run-up to his birthday, and you've got to learn to recite, you know, Tam O'Shanter, and you have art competitions, and you have music singing competitions. Singing's a huge thing, and it's singing, you know, Burns songs, which was his work was really, a lot of his work was putting lyrics to old folk staples. So it's really, really a strong part of the culture where I was from when I grew up. Which was, you're a wee bit older than me. I mean, you don't look it.
I am quite a bit older than you.
But I don't know if it was the case when you were a kid, but certainly when I felt it, like in 74, like things like decimalisation still felt very new, because my mum and dad would still talk about two bob, shillings and stuff. They would still talk, because they were born in the 50s, they would still talk about rationing, and they would talk, you know, just the war was very, very heavily there. And that's something that's in these strips as well. It's not overtly mentioned, but there are wee things here and there which really hint at it. The constant lack of money is one thing. There's rarely extravagance in either of those strips. There's only a couple of things when there's a lot of food on the table, and then they've got a TV, and funnily enough, it's the same TV we had in my house when I was a kid. This big wooden monstrosity that weighed about 8 tons. I remember my mum and dad when they were getting rid of it, I was like, I'll take that in my flat, and then I swear to God, lifting it on the stairs, it was so heavy, and it was, and all the buttons used to fall off it as well, and you had to put them back in place. So it was good. So that's there in those strips too. So there's a very, very strong cult, there's a very, very strong Scots language element to it, which has made it all the more remarkable that it's lasted as long as it has. And again, I think that adds the old-fashioned feel to it. It is absolutely a barrier, I think, for a lot of young people. I remember it being a little bit of a barrier for me when I was a kid, because it just reads like Burns or something. And I think that's probably why it's there with the poems. But again, it's East Coast Scots rather than West Coast. We use different words.
Okay, so we know that it was drawn by Dudley D. Watkins up until he sadly died at his drawing board in 1969.
Yes.
We've talked about him a bit when we did Lord Snooty with Robert Hagen back in episode 288.
Yes.
Here we have two of his sort of key pieces of work. What do you make of his artwork, and what do you see as differences between the two strips in terms of art?
I was actually quite surprised there was such a big difference between, not so much, the slight differences in the art style in the strips from looking at both as they evolve. And I could be wrong, but to me, Oor Willie looks and feels looser, that he was doing. It's the same underdrawing and construction is there in the figures. You see it in the figure work. You see it in the shapes that he uses. Oor Willie's really interesting because, again, one of the things I was reading about his artwork, I'm trying to think, I think it was maybe, it's when David Roach was saying Watkins' art was detailed and direct, with each panel showing full figures and detailed backgrounds. I would agree with that to an extent on the Bruins, not so much on Oor Willie. The backgrounds there are notable for telling the story in a very minimal, very balanced way. And I think that's because for a couple of reasons. I think from reading both strips, I would assume the Bruins was his favourite strip to draw.
Right.
It just really comes out. There's a lot of love in the Bruins. I mean, it's I think over the piece, and again, you know, it's obviously horses or courses, I think it's funnier more consistently. I think it's easier to be funnier because there's so many characters as well, and because you've got that conflict. I think it's easier, and certainly from experience, it's easier to write a large cast of characters than a small cast, because you've got so many different, like, conflict comes from triangular relationships more than anything else, because you're introducing a foreign element into a dyadic relationship. That's harder to do in Oor Willy, because it tends to be those kind of binary relationships, him to his mum and dad, him to PC Murdoch, him to his pals. And eventually that's something he gets the hang of a wee bit later on past these strips, where you see a lot more of Wee Eck, Soapy Souter, Fat Bob and him together. He introduces Jimmy, so it becomes a much more balanced strip. That wasn't quite there in these ones with me. But I think the thing that I'd said earlier on about he pulls the same trick with his main protagonist, I don't know if you noticed this, was the way that he spots blacks, which is where you fill in like large sections in black. Oor Willy's design is black bungarees.
Yeah.
With very little light on rim, or rather rim lighting in there. So you know when you see Black Panther, you have those blue highlights.
Yeah.
Don't get a lot of that in Oor Willy. It's very much solid blacks. Very bold design. If you were to apply the Toth rule, sorry, I just had to mention them. You apply that to
take a drink.
I'll do it twice. Of, you know, a strong silhouette that is there in all the character designs, like, you know, particularly Oor Willy, you know, the spiky hair, the, you know, the shape of the dungarees, the boots, the bucket. If you've seen it once, you would not mistake it again. I mean, it really is iconic, and that's, I would equate that to something like, in terms of Scottish, just the iconic design of Iron Brew or a Tunnock's tea cake. It's a classic, an absolute design class. Perfect. The Bruins, I would say, en masse are two. Hen has a very different silhouette than Joe. You could maybe get Paw Bruin and Grandpa Bruin mixed up. You maybe get Paw Bruin mixed up with Desperate Dan. Because of that shape, almost barrel chested. You know, they're very distinct. But to me, Oor Willy feels like it was drawn much quicker, much more loosely. And I'm not saying it's not any worse for it. It's very dynamic. Whereas, because of the ensemble cast, you maybe have to slow down because there's more blocking involved in it. You've got to figure out what the characters are. And this is the thing, like, I remember years ago watching the extra features in a Seinfeld DVD, and Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld were talking about how they used to write it, and how they get complaints off the actors if they didn't all have an arc in each episode. So that's how they worked out the ABC side of it, beginning, middle and end, for each character in each episode, so they converged. Which is like a Hardy Boys mystery. It's the way they used to work. Like, their dad's always away in some mysterious adventure, and then he shows up in a disguise, coincidentally, at the end of their case to save them, the Deus Ex Machina. In the Bruins, it's not like that, because it's a one-page Sunday strip. So they can do that from a story point of view, but they do it visually. And that's one of the things that Frank Quitely, Dave Gibbons talk about in their conversation, is that one thing that Dudley D is genuinely great at a lot of things, and you can see how he's getting tighter and tighter and more polished. Again, it's like reading Peanuts. You see them start to slowly evolve that design, and then it's just nailed, and it's very, very early on with the Bruins. It's a wee bit longer for Oor Willy. But it's still happening quick. And those strips had been running for 10 years by the time he was doing this. I was quite surprised that Oor Willy still had that, you know, just that kind of earlier design. But he's a master of gesture, and that really comes out in the Bruins. And if you see them in the... He'll do these long panels, and he shows all the characters. They're all doing something different. They're all doing something different, but they're all reacting differently to the same thing, which is incredibly hard to do with so many characters. And when you come on to Grail Pages later, which is always one of my favourite parts of your episodes, when people talk about that, there are so many pages in here. This isn't good for your listeners, but you can see the number of pages I've marked.
You've tagged there, yes.
Aye, because it's just incredible. But there's one page in particular that absolutely blew me away. I was just like, Christ, it's jaw-dropping, and it's got everything in there. It's got hatching, it's got spotting of blacks, it's got chiaroscuro, which you want for a black and white newspaper strip, because the paper quality, it's so strong. The gestures, unbelievable. The storytelling, the sense of motion, it's really funny. And I think he probably was writing it by himself by that point, rather than R.D. Lowe been heavily involved. And I think that was a set-up thing, like, you know, the whole, you know, when Pat Mills and John Wagner talk about the difference between a creator and someone that develops the strip, I'm assuming that's what that editorial role was. I'm assuming he had quite a lot of input as well with regards to the Scots language, because W.D. Watkins was English, which is funny that, you know, a lot of people think he's Scotland's greatest ever cartoonist, but he's not actually Scottish. Although he did move to Scotland when he was 18 to go to Glasgow School of Art and then got up to work for DC Thompson. So, in fact, when I read the strip as well, it's funny just quickly saying about that, I know it's going off his art style, his writing style is, it reads to me like a romanticised ethnography of Scottish working class life at the time. That's how good it is. I think it's almost journalistic, but it's still funny, it's still charming, and it's still not relying on the... I mean, I absolutely do love Ken Reed and Leo Baxendale, but there's a shock element to it, you know, because it's so over the top. It's like comparing Benny Hill, I'm really dating myself, I need to get better reference. It's like to, you know, very gentle... Or no, not gentle, but like Hancock's Half Hour. Do you know what I mean? Like those very different, like really frenetic humour style to something which is subtler, maybe and rooted more in that kind of working class side of things. Not that there was anything like Benny Hill and the Beano, that was a terrible example. But just the pacing round about it, there's a gentler pacing to the Bruins and Our Willie. It's nice.
Yeah.
It's reassuring. There's a really, really strong sense of family in the Bruins. And the thing that really jumps out to me about Our Willie, and this is in the combination of the writing and the art, it's a real sense of community.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Even the community policeman, and it's safe and it's reassuring, which is great.
I noticed that Our Willie's panels are, there's more of them on the page, they're more uniform in size. Perhaps unsurprisingly, with the Bruins, where sometimes he's got to have 11, there's 11 members of the family.
Yes.
So the panels are bigger, they change shape more often. You've mentioned that everybody gets something to do, which is fantastic. I'm thinking of Peter Cushing, the actor, who always liked to know what the props were, which props he could interact with on a set. And he doesn't just draw the members of the Bruins. They're all, when they're in a scene or they're in a, you know, a strange building or something, they're all interacting with something. It's so wonderful.
It's the famous story of Meryl Streep in The Deer Hunter, where I think it's Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro are acting, they're really intense, and she's in the background eating an apple. just like famously trying to steal by eating an apple. And it's funny because I then remember reading something else that in the Ocean's 11 film, that's why Brad Pitt is eating in every
eating
scene,
all the time.
It's just an in-joke, like he's eating them. It's just, and I don't know if it's because George Clooney like dared him to it, because, you know, they're famously good pals and playing practical jokes on each other. I love reading about that kind of stuff. I don't know why. It's just a nice thing. There's one thing, I don't know if you noticed this. If you look at Our Willie, it's not just a panel, transitions to panel shapes. It's 5 tiers. And the Bruins is 4 tiers. And if you look at a traditional Sunday strip, a Sunday strip, like an American one would be in colour. I only ever remember seeing Our Willie and the Bruins in black and white. But online I've seen the Bruins in colour, but I don't ever remember seeing that. Certainly always the annuals, or the alternate annuals, the biannuals, were black and white. So it's 4 tiers. It looks like a Sunday strip. It feels like a Sunday strip. It's a one-page story. And that is a remarkable skill. With 11 characters to be able to tell a one story, beginning, middle, and end, and it's funny. And there's an element of, I think there's more of an element of pathos in Our Willie, because there's more room to play with to set it up. I think you can do more with the story than you can with the Bruins. And they did break up the characters quite a lot. So not everyone's always in it. And that's why Pa Bruin is usually the protagonist. But Our Willie is a 5-tier strip, and it's a Sunday strip. Now, what I wondered when I was reading it was, because it's always the same, was this specifically designed to be broken up into 5 daily strips? Because if you read it, it reads like five daily strips, the way that it's structured. And it's unusual there's that number of panels, because if you read a daily strip, and we talked about adventure strips before, Frank Bellamy's ones, there's a smaller number of panels. And it's funny, when I was reading Ur-Willy, is the pacing on Ur-Willy is more frenetic, which might be that kind of sense of anarchy that people pick up on that I'm not saying it's not there, it's just I'm not really seeing it. I think it's probably because I was quite a naughty wee boy, so I was quite tame in the stuff he was doing. We didn't have catapults or go-karts. We used to steal kitchen knives and go and play knifey in a rope swing, stuff like that. You plant a knife into the ground and swing out and try and get it back without taking off your fingers. So it was a wee bit more of an edge to it. God, I was obsessed with the go-karts. It was always building go-karts. I was like, oh man, I'd love to do that. Really, really good. Whereas the Bruins, it's a gentler paced thing, because it has to be, because you say the panel sizes have to be longer.
Yes.
What's interesting is he never breaks that four tier and five tier setup, which is really interesting. So he could have been, that could have been because it's a time saving thing, because you're in that grind of producing it.
Yeah.
But he's not just doing two Sunday strips. He's doing Desperate Dan and Lord Snooty and Biffo the Bear as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing an amazing amount of work. Yeah,
it's an incredible amount of work. I mean, you see the art style from what I've seen, Desperate Dan varies in quality for me, and it's his line work. So this is from memory, so I might be completely misremembering this. His line work varies, whereas his line work on the Bruins in Ur-Willy is quite consistent. It looks to me like a crow quill and brush. And he's not doing a lot of hatching. Do you think I'm obsessed with this now after the Frank Bellamy one? That's only there in a couple of strips. And the one like later on that just blew me away, it's there. And it was just like, oh my God, this guy can do anything. But he did serious strips as well. Do you want me to read you just the thing that Dave Gibbons and Frank quietly said about him? Because it answers some of your questions.
Yeah, go on.
So they're talking about comics, and Dave Gibbons is saying about the things that he likes in Frank Quitely's work. So Dave Gibbons brings it up. He said, I mentioned DC Thompson earlier on. An interesting thing to me about what you do is that your work is kind of superheroes as filtered through DC Thompson. That wonderful artist, Dudley D. Watkins, who could draw anything. That man could draw funny, straight, dramatic, anything. And your work always reminds me of that. So I'd be particularly interested to hear about your influences. And Frank quietly says, well, obviously Dudley D. Watkins is a huge influence. He was the artist who did a strip called Ur-Willy and another strip called The Bruins, which appeared in the Scottish newspaper every Sunday, The Sunday Post. This guy was just phenomenal. He could capture just very, very realistic facial expressions and body language, from jealousy to embarrassment to anger to smugness, with very, very few lines. He was just phenomenal. The thing I loved about Watkins' work was the fact that if something was happening, that was the focal point of the scene, which is something we spoke about. Everybody in the panel would be reacting in some way to what had been going on in the same way that Norman Rockwell does. And Dave Gibbons says, there's another quality in your work that I can see in Dudley Watkins as well, and I like to think it's in some of my work, and that's the impression you get that the artist likes people and is interested in people. Real human people, not larger than life, godlike, symbolic people. It's just that crackle of humanity and the odd gesture or the way of looking or the slight paunch or the wrinkly clothes. It brings a warmth to the work. And I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
There is so much humanity, that community, that family in these strips. And, you know, obviously he had 33 years to do it. And these are 10 years in, so he's built that up. You know, he's got the hang of it. But when you take into account that, you know, he was doing illustrated stories, wasn't it? It wasn't comics. And this is 10 years in, so he's a veteran by then. But it's still so remarkable. I mean, how many comics have you read that are that depth of humanity? I mean, I suppose people talk about Jack Kirby with Stan Lee and Fantastic Four as one that leaps out. But it's not like the Bruins where... It's one page.
Just one page, one family.
Exactly. You've got to do the story, you've got to do all the characters. It's just, so the balance there is incredible. And it's not just the balance in the story, it's not just the balance in the narrative, it's the balance in the art. And that is remarkably hard to do. I wish it was easier to do, trust me. But also, it is more fun working with a large cast of characters to me, because that's the type of comics I do, because you're drawing different things and it's fun, you know. And so if you're getting bored drawing the same character and keeping it on model over and over again, you've got that constant almost exercise and energy of drawing different characters, even though it's the same type of underdrawing, the same basic shapes, your same style. So it's incredible. The motion thing and the gesture thing, it actually reminds me a little bit of the way the characters move. So the characters, particularly noticing the Bruins, they move across the panel. So it's lateral movement. And that actually reminds me of, I'm not saying he picked it up from him, because when you look at time periods, it doesn't match up because Ditko came later. It does remind me of Steve Ditko, though. And one of the differences between Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby was Jack Kirby did that forward movement, you know, moving towards you, foreshortening.
Yes, coming out of the page, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas Ditko was, you know, Spider-Man moving across the page, like skittering up walls and stuff. The Bruins is like that. You would see, particularly later on in the book, in quite long panels of them running or in motion together. And that's your money shot in the Bruins, is them all together doing something funny.
Yeah.
And Oor Willie, because of those smaller panel sizes, you see more action coming towards you, away from your use of perspective. It's less flat. So there is there's a big difference in the, not the style of the strip, but the approach to the strip and the way that he shows movement and gesture.
And I like what you say about him, or you quote about him just being interested in people and having, yes, a love of people and community and family, which is wonderful. Frank Quitely is interesting because I thought the son, the Bruins' son, Joe, has got that sort of square-jawed, broken-nosed face that I associate with Frank Quitely. And there's a couple of scenes of them, just panels of them walking, which I thought, oh yeah, I can see Frank Quitely's been looking at this as well.
When I was reading, I remember reading All-Star Superman, and I remember thinking at the time, his underdrawing is very like Desperate Dan, genuinely.
Mm.
You know, the big jaw, barrel chest. And it's obviously, you know, you can see it as an extrapolation of, you know, George Reeves' Superman, which is the living embodiment of Kurt Swan. Oh my gosh, what's his other name? What's the other one? Other really famous Superman artist. I'm not going to look it up, don't worry.
Frank Boring or...
Wayne Boring, that's it, exactly. Perfect.
Wayne Boring, yeah.
And Murphy Anderson Inc. and Kurt Swan. There is so much DC Thompson in All-Star Superman. There really is. And I think the biggest element is that humanity. I mean, it absolutely is. It's just, you know, and I think that's two guys, because there's no way Grant Morrison didn't grow up reading the Sunday Post.
Yeah.
That's that DC Thompson influence.
Yeah. Well, I'll mention Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely in a documentary in a moment. But before we do that, Dudley D. Watkins was drawing everything weekly. They don't conscript him during the war because he's important to national morale. He still finds time, though, even in these strips, he still finds time for some of those inky noodlings that you're such a fan of.
Yeah. And he was doing an extra strip as well for called William the Warrior. I don't know if you came across that.
No.
That was for... So he was, by all accounts, a devout Christian. And there is that strong element of Protestantism. Famously, DC Thompson, who, it was one of the things I was reading in the Masters of British Comic Art, David Roach wrote that they didn't employ Catholics in DC Thompson early on. And it is unfortunately a rather sad side of Scottish society that sectarianism happens, you know, most famously in our football. But he drew William the Warrior, and he drew that in a weekly basis for a Christian newspaper for free. Alongside his work. I don't know if the guy slept, frankly. I mean, it is really prolific. I mean, I know it's short, like if you're doing like 2-page strips for like Desperate Dan and stuff, but I mean, that's incredible, because that's a weekly comic.
Yeah.
You know, so he's producing, doing a newspaper strip is not the equivalent of doing a comic book page. There is more work in it. And a lot of the work is in the thought, because you're having to figure out telling a complete story in a page. It's harder to do. Like, the longer the story gets, well, that's not true. It's like a curve. You know, up to, say, 7 pages, it's hard to tell the story. But then when you get to 20 pages, it's easier. Then when you get to 30 pages, you know, it's still pretty easy. But then when you get to, you know, past 60, 70, 80, 90, when you get to 100, it's harder again. So it's just, it's, you know, it's just a completely different approach and a completely different approach to structuring your narrative. What he was doing, because he was a cartoonist, again, I do think he was getting editorial input for the Scots language side of things. Either that or he had a tremendous ear. But I mean, that's it's amazing what he was able to produce. And then he's doing extra stuff on top of it. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And doing the doodlings as well, which is just remarkable.
Now, to say that the Brunes and Ooil Willy are national institutions in Scotland would be putting it mildly. You've mentioned statues, you mentioned cookbooks. The Christmas Annual is an institution.
Yes.
I was watching the BBC Scotland documentary Happy Birthday, the Brunes from 2005, which is on YouTube, and I'll link to it in the show notes, narrated by Ewan McGregor, featuring Grant Morrison, Frank Quietly, Muriel Gray, the actress Elaine Smith, and several other fans. I mean, they're huge, basically, aren't they?
Yeah, I think the Brunes, though, maybe misremember it. I'm pretty sure they came quite close to not so much cancellation, but there was a huge dip in popularity. And it was that Brunes, and this may be my flawed memory, but the Brunes cookbook really brought it back. It certainly made it much, much more visible. It became very prominent. And then you've had, and again, this is visual prominence rather than, I don't actually know what the sales are like in the annuals. But I mean, we were speaking before we went kind of on air about if you go to the V&A in Dundee, you know, is this prominent Brunes and Ooil Willy in the gift shop. There's not so much within the exhibits at all. It's very, very tokenistic. So I don't know if it's shifted from, you know, like a kind of different variation of what's happened with Marvel and DC, where it's not really about the comics. It's about the IP. So like for a long time, since the 60s, and why Ditko left Spider-Man was around Marvel, Martin Goodman, Reagan, and licensing deals. It's about the T-shirts, the pants, you know, the films, the cartoons, the toys.
Yeah.
So with the Brunes, there's an awful lot of stuff you can buy with the Brunes on them, you know, like plates, cups, mugs, you know, T-shirts, whatever. So it's that recognisable IP, but they're still doing the comics. You know, I think the high watermark still is Dudley D. Watkins, though. Even though there was guys on it for like 30 years afterwards, it's still Dudley D. Watkins, because he is genuinely a great, great cartoonist.
Mm-hmm. Did the Carl Giles collections have any sort of penetration in Scotland?
Aye, so I remember seeing them and really liking them. I have to make a confession here, because I was so into comics that I used to read the comic strips in my mum's copies of Women's Own.
Sure, yeah.
As well, I read my sister's comics too. I read anything with comics in it, and I was obsessed with it and the different shapes. You know, we got all the same. We get Scottish versions of all the newspapers you got. So instead of like the Daily Express or the Daily Mail, it was a Scottish Daily Express, Scottish Daily Mail. It was occasionally quite funny when Scotland and England played football. I remember once it was after England beat us in the qualifiers, and Paul Scholes scored twice against Hampden, and then the last ever game at the old Wembley, when we beat you at the last ever game at the Wembley, with Don Hutchison scoring that goal. And you still knocked us out 2-1, which was sad. I don't hold a grudge. I was actually going on a bus from England to Scotland. And so it was funny seeing the same newspaper headlines changing as you cross the border, from slagging off Scotland and England to like just this very anti-English sentiment. Because that's what sells papers. you know, so aye, but we get the same stuff as you. And the thing is, when we were growing up, I mean, the newspaper strips that were in, because obviously we get American strips alongside tremendous British comic strips. You know, so there was quite a few Scottish comic strips. There was Angus Ogg, Lance McLean, which you've mentioned before when you're talking about Jeff Hawk, Cindy Jordan, and The Record. You know, there's been other various different strips in what was the one that was in the Evening Times, it was now the Glasgow Times, Lobby Dosser and the GI Bride, which was Bud Neil. And if you come up to Glasgow, there's statues of them. And there's a statue of Lobby Dosser, there's a wee cowboy and his horse, which is outside what used to be the Halt Pub, which was the pub that Bud Neil drank in. So again, these are maybe a bit forgotten about now, but you know, the statues are there because you know, it is an important part of our heritage. I think I'm pretty sure that Dudley D. Watkins' house was the first blue plaque that was erected in Scotland as well.
Right.
So by Historic Scotland. So it's, I think I read that somewhere. In fact, I'm pretty sure I did. So I know they're really, really important. I mean, the Urwell and the Bruins, it is, you're right, you can't understate it. I don't know, my kids would recognise it as something. Particularly Urwilly, and but it is because the bucket trail and stuff, but it's hugely iconic. And like, I'm sure there's been an Urwilly play or musical, and there's been cartoons and stuff like that. So, or certainly there's been animations for the anniversaries.
The only equivalent I could think of was the Giles collections over here, the Giles family. And, you know, they're a very English family. And still, the Giles annual, or the Giles collection appears every Christmas. Yeah. It's in my local bookshop. The Royal National Lifeboat still doing Giles Christmas cards to raise money. So, yeah, that was the equivalent I could think of was Giles over here.
That's another way you used to
or
get
down here.
Yeah, they weren't as popular, but you did get, and I'll be honest, I thought they were terrible. I never liked the strip, the Gambles. I remember seeing those collected a few times. But no, you're right. I mean, the Giles things were huge, huge. You still get them in some gift shop up here every year, and like they put them out in Watersons as well, so they still had a big deal. His stuff, it's funny just you saying that. His stuff, it would have been in my adult life. I don't know why. It must be something to do with the line weight, or maybe the underdraw. Just always reminds me of Charles Adams. Strips as well.
Okay, turn your back to this book. Which is your favourite of the strips? Is it the Bruins or Urwilly?
It's the Bruins. I love Urwilly as a character. And like I said, I was genuinely surprised reading back through it. The amount of times I actually laughed out loud. And, you know, like I said, it's the ones I find funniest, the silliest ones, like for the stupid stuff. The twins are going to be asking her in the family, how does a chimney sweep know his chimney to clean? And Barbara goes up to the chimney, he just shouts up at us, woo! And then his face and the entire family's covered in soot. It's daft. Any kind of humour where there's the protagonist shown to be an idiot, which is a Scots word for idiot, dafty, just cracks me up because it reminds you. There's a lesson in it as well. It's not just funny. It's a reminder to yourself, don't take yourself so seriously because you're just a daft at heart. And that is a big thing, certainly where I grew up. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. So one thing about these strips, there's a particular type of humour in there as well. Do you know what gallus means, or gallusness?
No.
So it's a kind of Scottish thing. Right. The way I describe it is someone thinks they're great. Like, thinks are really like the cock of the walk. You know, it walks a bit like the cock of the walk, but there's a real irony in it because they think they act like they're so clever, but they know they're really stupid. And they're kind of taking the mickey out themselves a wee bit when they're doing it. Or you see these guys bang on like they're really handsome, but they're really just taking the mickey out themselves. And there's just a real gallusness where it's not arrogance at all because it's really, really laced with humour. And that, for me, it's absolutely there in Urwilly and the Bruins. It's much more strongly there in the Bruins because Paul Bruin is just, and Grandpa Bruin as well, they just are those fall guys, you know, but they're both the straight man and the fall guy, and that, I guess, is what a good way of describing gallusness. They're just so daft. So those are the strips I love best, where there's that kind of gallusness. And there's the butt of the joke. I do like the ones where like in the rain, like the downpour and stuff, when they try to play a hen and Joe are trying to play a joke on him, and he's got this wee clock that tells him a barometer that tells him what the weather is, and we're like, they try and swap around the wee figures that pop out, and he outsmarts them, But the nice touch in it, in that punchline, is everyone's getting soaked, apart from him, and apart from Maw and the bear, because he's brought a big umbrella for them. So there's a sweetness in there as well. Like, he really loves his wife, and he really loves his wee daughter, but he's teaching others a lesson. It just makes me laugh. The pettiness as well makes me laugh. So aye, but there's loads of strips in there. The one that stands out to me, though, in terms of, I think the chimney sweep one, which is page 123, really makes me laugh.
Let's just say thank you for the page numbers, DC Thompson. That helps.
Aye, you're bugging there. Aye.
Yeah. Page 123, the Bruins.
Yes. Yep.
From the Sunday Post, 9th of January 1955. Mm-hmm. And as you say, this is the chimney sweep story. So
that really makes me laugh. The one with the dog. The guy
comes
to the Bruins and he thinks it's his dog, but it's a random dog. And the dog's misbehaving and they're trying to be polite. That cracked me up. And the one where the Oor Willy one, where he's in, they send him to his bed because they think he's been bit by a rabid dog. It turns out he just dreamt it and he skinned his knee falling over. Right, and the doctor's out and they've been feeding him sweets and stuff like that. And he's really confused because, like, why have they been so nice to me? That made me laugh so much. That was in page 20. Oh, God, Daphne is a bit cruel, I suppose, because she's a butt of the jokes a lot, because she's not as glamorous as Maggie, is a nice way of putting it. But in page 33, when they're trying to help do her hair for whatever other disastrous dates, and they use the Hoover to try and dry it, and it just blows dirt all over her. And I guess she don't just mock it. It's a good Scottish word for you. That made me
laugh. It's a disaster. Yeah.
And the page 133, when Ma Bruin buys the etiquette book, and he uses it to prop up the table. I'm eating like pigs, which is my house. My son, see, you think I'm bad when I'm scoffing a curry down before starting your podcast. See, watching my son eat, it's the worst thing imaginable. He's a wee animal. But there's one, like, art wise, it's page 137. It's just absolutely remarkable. And I mean,
let's turn to page 137. So, this is from the Sunday Post, 1st of January 1956, the Bruins again. Tell us about this page.
So, it's one of the things that always plays really well in black and white comics, scenes with snow, particularly because you can get a chiaroscuro effect off it, which is that, you know, strong contrast between black and white. And he is a master of, you know, you've got a sparser landscape because it's white. And it's putting the emphasis in line weight. So if you've got a great line, it really shows up. One of the reasons why I love this strip is, so there's a few things. I mentioned to you earlier on when I was a wee boy, I became obsessed with catapults. I didn't mention the conker thing. I became obsessed with conkers, although they call it chessies, and go-karts. With the Bruins, the thing that fascinated me the most was the button Ben. It's a very Scottish thing of basically you go off that croft. Like, your family has a, like, you could be really poor, but your family, it's like a timeshare, like, across your entire extended family. You've got this wee button bed in the middle of nowhere, and it's about this very particular representation of rural life. So they're going out to this, and they've got a sled, that they're pulling their belongings along in, and then they get this button bed inside, and it's very cramped, and there's the hearth, and just the way he draws it is absolutely beautiful. And if you look at, like, there's just great scenes with, like, loads of character. There's great depth in panel one. There's all the gesture in panel two. There's the way that he uses foreground objects for depth in panel three. There's the hatching in panel four. There's an absolute show-stopping, very complicated ensemble scene in panel five, which is one of those long panels we're talking about. There's a beautiful panel, like panel six, small panel, I'm watching the skating. And then there's the final panel, money shot. And you can tell it's the New Year strip. You know, that's it has to be something special because it's the It's the New Year strip, and it is. It's I mean, it's a, to me, that is a work of art. The line work, the level of craft in it is just absolutely incredible. And if you actually compare it to the Oor Willie page next to it, which may be a bit unfair because, you know, the New Year strip and the Hogmanay strip, you know, they've got to be special. The Christmas Eve strip's got to be special. Boxing Day strip's got to be special. But you look at it, you can see that difference in the balance in the panels, which is partly what you're saying about the panel size, but also about just a different approach to backgrounds.
And a button ben is a sort of a hut, a winter hut.
It's always depicted more
a
like
bothy.
A croft. Aye, a bothy, aye.
A croft.
If you've ever stayed in a bothy, it's miserable. That's not a bothy, that's more like a croft because they've got a hearth. The bothy I've stayed in, it's like, it was a shed, plywood walls, and there's a shelf you sleep on in a sleeping bag, and you've never seen as many spiders and possibly mice in your life. And if you go, there's no toilet, so you're just going outside into the nettles to pee, and there's no heating. It's freezing. And quite a lot of time, there's no lights either. And when you're staying there, it's the middle of nowhere, and it's usually you and a bunch of smelly guys. And it's not a good experience at all. You're not cuddling together in your sleeping bags for warmth because it's so cold. That's something that's a bit nicer. It's an idealised version of a button ben, which is more like the Highland croft. And that was a recurring thing in the Bruins, like that kind of time of year they would go to, which is night, which is the only time it's kind of breaking out of that. I think it was a working class thing, but this is before packaged holidays in the 50s, before that became popular. But again, it's that shortbread, tin representation of Scotland when you get into things about the idealised rural life for people who live in the big cities.
So I will post the page, the Hogmanay page, which ends up with them curling on the ice. I will also post the Chimney Swift page and your Oor Willie page of them tucked up in bed when they think he's been bitten by the rabid dog. So I'll post all those when this episode comes out, which will be just in time for Hogmanay. This is your Christmas annual episode, so perfect timing.
Merry Christmas, Eamon.
And to you.
And Happy New Year.
So, the Bruins and Oor Willie, the golden years, they are actually, like these DC Thompson, they're fairly easy to get hold of secondhand. It's out of print now, I think, but it's fairly easy to get hold of. It's certainly, I think, cheaper than the £8.25 that's listed inside the dust flaps. Thank you for sending it to me.
Yeah, your copy was really expensive. I feel I should point that out.
Was it? Okay.
£150. And all the way... Yeah, they were actually surprisingly cheap. But I mean, again, I have no idea what the I'm really fascinated to find out the circulation on them now. But they are so
well.
They are a bookshop.
The yearly annuals continue. It's a Bruins one this year for 2026. It's their 90th birthday next March for both of them. So happy birthday to the Bruins and Oor Willie.
Happy birthday.
And I will link to that BBC Scotland documentary, which is, I think, quite a fun watch.
Can with I ask Frank Munn. Just before you finish up, how were you with the language side of it, out of curiosity? Did you find it a big... Did it take you a while to get into it? Or were you just...
Yes. Yes.
Did you know beforehand, though, that it was Scots?
I knew there were certain catchphrases and expressions that seemed to come from these two strips. Right. And I probably will be saying Crivens quite a bit for the next few weeks.
Aye.
And it did take me a while... to get the rhythm of it. It's very definitely written in sort of Scotch, as you say.
Scotch.
But yeah, no.
Oh, Scotch. Scots. Scotch is a drink.
Okay.
Scots. Aye. I saw funny with that. Aye.
But at all of it, you've got the comic genius of Dudley D. Watkins drawing. So, you know.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
It helps. It really helps.
And thanks for answering the bat signal and coming and explaining it to me. I now understand the guy sitting on his bucket.
Aye, thank you for indulging my an opportunity for me to reminisce about my gran and papa.
That's nice.
It's lovely talking about this. It's very. I honestly thought this would be an exercise in nostalgia for me, and honestly, I was really surprised how funny I found these. It's maybe an age thing. I've got to that age. I've aged into the Bruins. But no, I did find it very, very funny. And the level of cartooning is just, I mean, it really is, it's really breathtaking at times. It is phenomenal. I agree with Frank Quiley, it's phenomenal. It really is.
So, yes, and you'll see Frank Quietly and Grant Morrison on the sofa talking about this, the Bruins, in the documentary. Now, we have, as ever, Johnny, run a bit long, but guest projects, your comics.
I'm working on a comic which will be out next year, and that when it's out next year, I'll have taken 3 years. It's called The United Five Triangles. I've done two previous hardback fancy fat comics, as Tony Esmond calls them. The United Welcome to the Shit Show and United Going Underground. So it's a lot of the same characters again, but it's a standalone story. One thing I noticed was, because someone was asking me to describe the comics I make that doesn't read comics, and I was describing it, and I just really realised they're progressively getting weirder. And the last book was pretty weird. This one's been really weird. And it's a bit like a cross between, like, if David Lynch got together with, like, David Lynch was doing a Captain Britain comic for Marvel UK in the 80s, or a comic for Vertigo in the 90s, is that kind of vibe, but with a lot of Alex Toth thrown in there. But there is absolutely a lot of Urwally and the Bruins in there as well. I think there is, for any Scottish person that's drawing comics that's grew up reading it, because it just sinks in. You know, there's conscious influences, and there's subconscious influences that you have as well. It's your influences don't just come out in the way that you're purposely trying to draw. It's what you've learned, because you're learning to draw as you're learning to read at the same time when you're a tiny wee kid. If you're that kind of way inclined. So that's what I've been working on for a long time. I wish it didn't take so long, but it's been really, really fun doing it. And it's I'm really, really happy with it. It's interesting looking back. The only time I ever look over my old comics is when I'm doing a new one. And so it's for a kind of continuity thing, usually to remember, what's that guy's name again? Is this character actually dead and I've forgotten? Usually the two things. But it's nice to see a transition, you know, like getting better at making comics and just being at a point in time where I'm absolutely nowhere near the level I want to be. I'd be worried if it was plateauing, but I can see that improvement. I can see the gradient, and it's good, really, really good. So I'm loving doing that, but it'll be nice to finish it, and that'll be the last United comic I do. It's a standalone story, but that takes it to a place that I'm happy to leave it alone and do other things, because I've had other comics, you know, ideas for comics like that are researched, and, you know, kind of the beats are worked out, they've been sitting there for 15 years, and I'd rather do them than somebody else come up with the same idea and then be like, oh damn it, which has happened several times before. So I actually created Spider-Man, not a lot of people know this, and then Stan Lee stole my idea, even though I was born a decade after it was created. That's the story I'm sticking to.
Well, look in the show notes for this episode for a link to cannonhillcomics.bigcartel.com for Johnny's comics. Now, also, you've got your Substack, where you never mention Alan Davis, Alex Toth, or Frank Bellamy.
You need to get that digger in there. See, this Alex Toth thing, by the way, it's not true. I probably mentioned Harvey Kurtzman more than Alex Toth, but yeah, no, it's...
Oh, okay, I'm reckoning true.
No, it's not true at all. I'm absolutely defensive and evasive on it. I'm obsessed with Alex Toth. It's just so good, though. I mean, it's ridiculous. I started as a way of... Because I don't have any formal art training, and I love making comics, love drawing comics, and... I don't know if this is the same with yourself when you started doing the podcast, because when you're doing your podcast, you've got to look at comics more critically. And I don't know if that takes some of the enjoyment out of it, because if you're reading something for your podcast, you're reading it with a critical eye. The same with me. It's like when you know how the sausage is made, it's not quite the same. So there's an element of that. But I started doing the Substack because I was doing all this studying, and I was taking notes. And also, I'd done a few podcasts. I'd run doing quite a few podcasts. I had all these notes, and I didn't know what to do with them. And it was one of the first newsletters I did was actually the notes from the Frank Bellamy episode we did.
Right.
And linked into that. And just when I was doing it, because I used to, like a few years ago, I used to do a lot of work in academic research. I worked in a university. And I was so used to referencing. And it just thought, if I'm going to do this, I want to be able to find things and go back to the source to see if there's anything else I missed. So your podcast appears in my newsletter a lot and you know, like the hyperlinks and stuff. Same with cartoonist Kayfabe, Never Eye on Anything, you know, pop up quite frequently. There's resources that are great to draw. The Grand Comics database is incredible. I think it's the best comics resource out there. The Comics Journal, their digital archive, Lambiec, their kind of encyclopedia of comic creators, which is phenomenal, a great starting point. So I really like doing it, and yeah, it seems to be grown in popularity, which is a nice surprise. But just like making comics, that's a nice side to it. I really do it for myself, and it is study notes, and I do go back to them quite a lot, because I just, you know, have a busy day job and a busy family life and do forget things. I think you can overanalyze comics though when you're making them, and it slows you down. You just overthink the page. But I've surprised myself the stuff I've been looking at. I mean, I knew that I'd do a lot in Toth because he's been really important to the way I make comics and draw in particular over the past few years, and David Mazzucchelli. I was surprised the amount of stuff I've done in EC Comics. I still need to put in a link for your Bernie Krigstein episode. I keep forgetting to do that. But that was one of the things that really encouraged me to go back and look at stuff. Because when I saw it when I was younger, I hated it. I thought it was so ugly. And then when you go back over it and you actually look at it and understand what it's doing, you're just like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. The guy is a genius. And he's one of those guys like a Mazzucchelli, much more than a Steranko, but guys that have got a very relatively small body of work. He's leave comics, certainly mainstream comics, but they leave such a huge footprint. Which is the opposite of someone like a Toth, where a lot of people think, oh, the guy didn't do a lot. The guy did a huge amount of work, you know, in comics and animation over 5 decades. You know, oh, he didn't have a masterpiece. That's not true. Like, there was a lot of, it's not like someone like a Toth, the masterpiece is not in a comic run. It's in a panel. It's in a page. I mean, some of his page designs it's not depressing now the way it was when I was a kid, you know, because I get so disheartened I'll never be able to draw like that. It's inspirational now, which is good. Right. So I have a lot of fun doing the Substack, and it's great because it also encourages me to listen to, you know, your podcast, other podcasts, and doing a lot of studying through the week. And I feel that it improves the comics that I'm making myself. So thank you. I really do mean that. Like, your podcast is a fantastic resource. It's really good. It's very inspirational.
Well, you're very welcome, Johnny. And go to canonhillcomics.substack.com for all of this, including this week, as this episode comes out, you'll be putting up your Dudley D. Watkins notes. So you can read more of Johnny's thoughts about the genius there.
Yes. I'll maybe time it with your episode I'm going to surprise you.
The week this comes out.
Yeah.
Okay.
There is a football theme. Which does
fair enough.
Go into great length about Scotland v Denmark, and then goes into Billy's Boots and Hotshot Hamish. I love Hotshot Hamish. I love Hulu Sheafido's artwork. I think it's incredible. And also references. I won't go into the story for your family friendly podcast of Alfie's Special Socks, my vulgar version of Billy's Boots that I did a few years ago with Gavin Boyle. So I might do that one, or I could do this one, and I might combine them both because there's a Scottish theme that runs through them all.
Look in the show notes, Cannon Hill Comics on Big Cartel and on Substack, and follow Johnny there. And that's it. Thank you very much to Johnny.
Jing's aiming. You're some man.
Help my Bob. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find all of these links that we've been talking about at megacitybookclub.com. Follow us on Threads, Facebook, Instagram, Mastodon, Blue Sky, Substack, and the 2000 E forums to see some of Dudley D. Watkins' artwork from The Bruins and Ooh Willie. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, with comments, suggestions, reviews, and books, creators, or stories that you'd like to come on and talk about yourself. So that'll do us. Until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from him. Yeah.